Blog Talk Radio.
Made a wrong turn once or twice, dug my way out, blood and fire. Bad decision, that's alright. Welcome to my silly life. Mistreated, please misunderstood. No, it's all good. It didn't slow me down. Mistaken, always second guessing. Underestimated, look, I'm still around. Pretty, pretty, please, don't you ever, ever feel like you're less than, less than.
Of this subject than to have both of them on. So with that being said, I'd love to get started in doing so. Nadine, would you mind walking us through the definition of intergenerational PTSD, or however you'd like to define it within your education?
Okay. We're actually looking at three different topics that in many ways are interchangeable, but they're not exactly the same. So I'm going to say three different terms, and then I'm going to give a definition of them. And then at that point, you know, as we discuss them, people will understand what we're saying. There are terms that most people are already going to be familiar with or have probably even experienced. The first one is called, as you said, intergenerational PTSD. The second one is cultural trauma. And the third one is called vicarious trauma. Now, the first one, intergenerational PTSD, I'd like to break it down, and it's pretty simple if you look at it that way. Intergenerational simply means a relationship between children, youth, adults, and seniors. In other words, intergenerational, the different generations of a family, so to speak. But in the way that we're going to talk about it today, we're looking particularly at the intergenerational relationship in terms of treatment and interactions. In other words, what's happening, we know all the wonderful things that come from that kind of relationship, but what happens if something goes wrong, particularly with one of the older ones? How does that affect the younger one? The PTSD part, we've talked about on a show prior to this, but just as a very brief refresher, PTSD stands for post-traumatic stress disorder. And as many of you know, back in World War II, it was called shell shock. In the Vietnam era was when the word PTSD or the term post-traumatic stress disorder first came on the scene. And since then, we've applied it to other extremely stressful events in which a person wasn't sure if they were going to live or die, including rape events and so forth, as post-traumatic stress disorder. So when we put intergenerational with PTSD, we're really looking at a way that younger people can be traumatized, not because they went through the initial trauma. You know, maybe the initial trauma was that somebody was taken from their biological parent and put into a boarding home or someplace where they were not cared for in the ways that they should have been. That was their trauma. And yet sometimes that person later on in life, whether it's with their own children or could even be their nieces or nephews or their spouse, they are still traumatized if they haven't been adequately treated for it or healed. And so the children can end up getting a secondary form of post-traumatic stress disorder. So when we're talking about PTSD, some of those symptoms include flashbacks, which are basically images of the trauma, sometimes distorted images. In an easy way to think about it is if a person has been in a war zone where somebody next to them was shot and killed, then they may have PTSD to the sound of what would appear to be a firearm. And in that second of hearing that, what they believe is a firearm, they are right back in that war zone again. They may have already dropped to the ground. They may be shouting an order. They are not here anymore. They're having a flashback. And similarly, if somebody was sexually abused as a child, it doesn't matter whether it was one time or whether it was many times. It doesn't matter whether the child tried to get away or whether they knew that they had to put up with it because that was what life was forcing on them at that moment. It is traumatic. And we've talked a little bit in the past about why some people experience more trauma from a seemingly the same event that somebody else may experience less trauma. So we have flashbacks, which are images, sounds, and so forth, that can actually trigger a person to go into a flashback. Recurring dreams, which I would say more than dreams are kind of nightmarish reenactments of the trauma, is also one of the symptoms of PTSD. One that a lot of people don't realize is avoidance of the trauma. And, you know, in a severe trauma, typically, unless a person's going through healing, they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to feel those feelings. They're awful. And they don't want to have to repeat it. And so I noticed in Australia, for instance, there has been a series of about one a week for quite a while where somebody accidentally rolls back in their SUV or car that they can't see in the rearview mirror very well and runs over and kills their own child. Now, there's no doubt in anybody's mind that that would be traumatic. And yet, if you were to ask that person about it, chances are they would not want to talk about it unless they were in the healing process. So we've got the intergenerational aspect, what we pass down from one to the next to the next, and then we've got the PTSD or the traumatic aspect of it, and how is it that we transfer a trauma from a grandparent who may have experienced something in a war to their child who was never in a war to their child who was still a child. How is it we do that? So that's called intergenerational PTSD. Now, the second one that's similar but not the same is called cultural trauma. Now, some of the similarities are that it also may have happened generations ago, whether it's somebody in Ireland who maybe it was their grandparent who experienced the abuse in a church situation or taken to one of the laundries where the women whose babies were just taken from them. They didn't have a chance to keep that child. And so this person has lived a lifetime not knowing who his own mother was or who her own mother was. A cultural trauma can be any culture. There is no one culture that has the last say in having cultural trauma. In the country that I live in the United States, there's severe cultural trauma with the Native American community. Again, it does not have to have happened to the person right now in this day and time. It might have happened to several generations before, perhaps even people who are no longer living. So how can that traumatize somebody who is still living, particularly a child? How can that potentially lead to such severe depression that this young person may consider suicide? So that's when we're talking about cultural trauma. The third one that's similar again but not the same is called vicarious trauma. It's similar to the other two in that you develop this kind of trauma from hearing about somebody else's trauma by not experiencing it directly. However, with intergenerational and cultural, there is a sense of continuing hearing it over and over. It's often apparent. Or somebody in a community with that person. An example of how someone might continue to be re-traumatized, as much as online sites where we are attracted to people who are of like mind, who have been through similar traumas, the downside of that is that it can serve to re-traumatize people. Even shows like this have that potential. And so when you are, going to those sites and listening to other people's traumas and it's bringing up perhaps your own all over again or whatever, just be aware that that's happening and you may need to develop some specific coping mechanisms and continue your own healing if you notice that's going on. But back to vicarious trauma. So what does it mean when I say vicarious? Most people, when they think of the word vicarious, they think of it as in pleasure, vicarious pleasure. If I have a child who is really excelling, and maybe they're really good in sports, and I go watch a game and they get the home run or they, whatever it is, the goal in football, and I have vicarious pleasure in seeing my child happy. Now, I think most of us understand vicarious pleasure, but vicarious traumatization is similar, and it often occurs with people who are in the helping professions and with people who do it as a profession, their license and so forth, chances are they know they're going to run into it, and so they try to prepare themselves. Even the best prepared professional has residual vicarious traumatization after any number of years of doing it. Now, in my own case, I've been a psychologist for decades, and I have been in the mental health profession for well over 30 years. And I can tell you that there are certain traumas that I still remember and don't want to, that people have told me about, because it brings up such vivid images. And, the last thing in the world I want is to be surrounded by that. So even when you're in a profession and trained for it, it can have the effect of some minimal traumatization. Now imagine that you are a child in a family where the parent, whether it's the mother or father, let's say in this case it's the mother, who was perhaps brutally raped as a child, and she can't get past it. She's not been able to get the kind of help she needs or with the right person, and so she is still living in that trauma. She's still having flashbacks. She's still having the nightmares, and she's still wanting to avoid it, but it comes up anyway. And let's say that every time somebody, she has a little girl, and every time somebody says something about she should date again or what about this guy or that, she gets triggered and says terrible things about men in general because of her horrible experience when she was younger. Well, what happens with the child is that they begin to feel traumatized. And even though there's nothing like that that's directly happened to them, they begin to experience it as if it did. So the vicarious transformation or traumatization is a transformation in the self. It's actual in ourself of who we are, of a trauma worker or a helper or a child, that results from empathizing with a traumatized person when they're talking about their traumatic experience. And one more thing before I stop for a bit, and hopefully you guys will chime in on this. There's an article by a person named Terry Spahn Nelson called Vicarious Trauma, and I thought she made a good statement, and that is, coping with the feelings and reactions to your client's trauma is the next step in addressing vicarious trauma. Now, that may not make much sense in terms of, well, what am I supposed to do, except the word coping is the word that I'm zeroing in on. Somehow, as parents, we need to learn, or as adults in the lives of children, we need to learn how to cope with our own traumatic reactions so that we are not inadvertently re-traumatizing or traumatizing for the first time our own children. And then I'll be quiet for a moment and see if you have anything that you want to add to that.
I did want to add something to the vicarious. When you were saying that, there's some of these shows that I've done, even the book readings, Annie's book reading, there's Michael. There's some of them that hit me so deeply that I replay it sometimes, and it creeps into my thoughts and even reading the book. So the subject matter that I'm working with could definitely trigger different things in me. So I think I need to take a little more time and make sure I'm more prepared than just walking in open to it, because it can definitely lead to triggering my own internal issues. So it's a very interesting concept.
I absolutely agree. I think that I had, like yourself, I had a radio show for many years, and I would interview people. And, when I'm in my psychology profession and I'm sitting in the consulting room, I know I'm going to hear traumatic things. But when I'm doing a radio show, I'm necessarily expecting it. And so, yes, it's absolutely imperative that anybody hearing these kinds of things, whether it's online or not, that you try to be prepared and cope with it. Yeah. And by the way, the healing for trauma, one of the most effective healings that I know of, if you're doing it with a person who knows what they're doing, that's a big if, is to actually describe the trauma, to go through it again and again in order to desensitize yourself to it so that you no longer feel the trauma. You can talk about it, and it's just, you know that it's there. But to re-traumatize yourself by hearing other people's and not having that same kind of healing is what I'm concerned about.
Yeah, it definitely is a hard thing to do, but that's what part of what I created the show for, is to give those stories a place. So there is a price to that that I'm perfectly willing to pay. But it definitely does exist, that it's a heavy subject and it's not always the easiest to carry or to hear, or, you know, I may end up in tears at the end of it some days, but that's fine. That's still nothing compared to what they had to suffer in actually living it.
Well, you know, an interesting thing is sometimes we're triggered. I'm talking about an unexpected trigger right now.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're triggered by things that we had no idea. I started watching a delightful movie last night on television, which some of you out there may have been watching or certainly would know about. It's called Pay It Forward.
Yes.
And it is a wonderful movie. It's about this little boy who comes up with a plan to improve the world by people doing an act of kindness to three strangers, and all that you want in return is to ask them to do it for three other strangers. So it's Pay It Forward. Well, I think the concept is wonderful. I think it's delightful. The movie is excellent. And I don't want to spoil the end, but I can tell you that the way it ended almost traumatized me.
I sat there
and could not believe I was so unprepared for it that I sat there and cried. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I've heard much worse. And yet it is that sense of not being prepared for it, being vulnerable, that we share with children.
Yeah.
Children are always vulnerable to this because they don't have in place yet the coping mechanisms that we develop as adults.
Or claim to develop as adults.
Or hope to develop.
Yeah, hope to develop.
It's never too late.
David, did you have anything you wanted to say before we kind of break it down more?
Not yet. Just paying as close attention as I can to this extraordinary topic. Like I said, you know, everybody can relate to this topic in one way or another and at varying degrees.
Right.
And are hit harder than others, so I think that this information is extremely important to get out there. So let's carry on and do it.
Yeah, I think that people who are empathic are drawn to help survivors, but in doing so, the empathic nature of them also pulls in the energy from it. So you have to be
very careful of the
energy.
And it results in them being potentially re-victimized. One of the things I want to say in terms of terminology today, generally I do not use the term victim.
Right.
I understand victimology and all that, but typically I prefer to talk about people who have gone through these things as survivors, because, in fact, I believe if you're still living, you're surviving. You know,
absolutely.
You didn't kill yourself. You're still here on the planet. And so in that regard, I believe that everybody is a survivor who has been through traumatic stuff, and they're still here, they're still hanging in. So when I use the word victim, I'm not talking about anybody that has been through this, that is listening to this show, because I hear you are trying to do something. What I am talking about is a state of victimization more than a person.
Yeah.
So when I talk about, you know, there are three people involved, essentially, in a trauma, and especially in intergenerational trauma. One is the victim, which may be the mother, you know, who was raped, or it may be the father who was raped, or it may be a grandparent who was sent to a gas chamber and escaped. So that's the victim in the sense of what happened. And then there is the perpetrator, which is whoever did that horrible thing. You know, sometimes the perpetrator is the person we also love. It might even be
a
parent.
That's true.
Yes, and or it might be a priest, somebody that we thought we could trust, somebody that we thought was there for us. And so, you know, and I don't want to paint any broad brushstroke over religion, because I know that a lot of people get a lot of positive about it. But that said, there are an awful lot of people, thousands of people out there perhaps, I'm certain of it, that have been traumatized by the actions of those bad apples. And so, you know, even though, you know, we have the victim, which is the person who experienced the trauma, we have the perpetrator, the person who perpetrated the trauma, And then we have an observer. Now, the observer is the one who's in danger of being traumatized in the vicarious nature of it, of listening, empathizing, and so forth. Now, I'm going to extend the definition of perpetrator a little bit, because generally when we think of a perpetrator, we think of a bad guy, you know, a person who has ill intent. They should know better. I want to propose the possibility, as we're talking about these particular topics, that a perpetrator may be inadvertent. I'm not talking about the priests. I'm not talking about the Nazis in Germany. I'm not talking about the intentional perpetrators, but I'm talking about, for instance, the mothers or the fathers or the family members who talk about their trauma.
Right.
Maybe it's generational, maybe it personally happened to them, but they talk about it without realizing that the observer is being traumatized.
Changed, yes. That I think is a huge percent actually of what happens, because a person is still within their own recovery, and they have no clue of the energy and the interaction that the child is picking up. And how, during their developmental process, they're learning things about life and how life is through watching this. So it definitely changes them. Before we get too far, I would like to pull Annie into this, because she's lived both sides of this. So, Annie, are you there?
Oh, yeah. You should write on your calendar, I've been so quiet.
No, no. But that's about to change. No, I know that you've lived both sides of the coin. Can you just give a brief background on your history and tell us what you think so far?
Sure. Well, I'm trying to think of an easy way to say this, and there's just not.
No, there's not.
There's not. My father was, he's dead now. He's a pedophile. He was sadistic. And I was 33 years old when I went into therapy. And I found a lot of the stuff you were saying was just remarkably interesting to me. I was really lucky I had an excellent therapist. And I went from not being able to say a word. I was hospitalized with depression, and all I had to say was, "My father molested me, and it's not my fault." I went from that to where I was so sick and tired of talking about it, I didn't want to talk about it anymore.
Oh, you had a great therapist then.
It was a huge success. And I'm not real sure where this falls in, but my kids, I'd had kids fairly young, so I mean they were a little bit older when I went into therapy. I had them in therapy, but one of them in particular picked up a lot of my behavior, so much so that her therapist was concerned that she had been molested and abused, and she had not.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught her that. Inadvertently, I had taught her that. I had obviously had no intention of doing that.
Which, of course, you would never, ever have done if you had been able to avoid it. If you had the treatment you needed earlier, you would never have done that.
No, as a matter of fact,
But we do that.
I went out of my way. My general rule was, if my parents did it, I wasn't doing it. So for years, I thought that was enough. Clearly it wasn't. I don't know, I'm just finding the whole thing really interesting.
Well, it's a different way to look at it, because I think so much of the focus on trauma, and particularly PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is on the initial victim, victimization, I should say. And so when we're taking a look at, okay, all right, we got it. We got that. We know we need treatment. Now what? Because now we're looking at you know, if you're thinking that the PTSD diagnosis actually didn't occur until Vietnam era, which was in the early 1970s, that we started using the term a lot, people were having children who were traumatized and beginning to have a sense of what did happen to them, and but we had no idea of how that was affecting our children doing exactly what you did, which was, I'm not going to do what they did, and thinking that was, okay, we're protecting our children. And so it's only been fairly recently that, you know, we've began to look at this intergenerational aspect of, whoa, how'd that happen? Now, the interesting thing about that is that most of the studies about intergenerational trauma come out of an earlier era, and it comes out of Nazi Germany, not Nazi Germany specifically, it comes out of this country, but it's from what happened in Nazi Germany when millions of people were taken to camps and slaughtered, basically. Some were able to get away and get past it, and most were not. But those that did get out of it, in fact, even those that never went to the camps but knew others who did and were traumatized by it, because after all, the definition of PTSD is not just that you were in danger of losing life or limb, but someone close to you was. And so many of these people came to the United States or Canada or to other countries suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. And amazingly, the Jewish culture, in spite of all of that, has done incredibly well in many, many ways. You know, there's some of the top people creatively in New York and Hollywood, and scientists, some amazing people came out of that. But some of the flip side of it was a sense of foreshortening of life that many people experienced, a sense of protectiveness of their children, never wanting to acknowledge that they're safe now. I've thought about this many times, the term Jewish mother, and I'm using it in the most positive, loving sense, because I know a lot of Jewish mothers. I think that this term, the pejorative term, actually came out of a sense of so many women were traumatized and trying desperately to protect their children from that ever happening again. And the irony of it was that because of their trauma, because of their anxiety, their children experienced an increased or a heightened sense of alarm and perhaps even anxiety. And, I've seen more than a few second or third generational client who, experienced out-of-control anxiety, not because of something that happened to them, but from growing up with someone who was traumatized.
Right. I may have done that to my daughter as well. Because I was always worried that there was some kind of pedophile around trying to get to her. So I always was, giving her the lessons of what to do with this and that. And it could have very easily. But the truth was, there was pedophiles around. So it's
absolutely.
How do you know when to not traumatize your child, but then to be able to protect them too? And the other piece is, when you've come from that hard, like Annie came from, or even to some degree where I came from, you have to learn how to love and how to nurture, because you didn't learn those skills. So by the time you've learned those skills, you're starting to hit your 30s. But chances are you gave birth in your late teens, early 20s.
Yep.
So your firstborn is going to be the one who suffers the most. So you may see the firstborn, the firstborn having the most trauma, and then the baby getting spoiled and acting like it was a completely different parent that raised them than the one that raised the first one, because it was. Yeah. So the firstborn, bless them, because sometimes they have the hardest road. No wonder they're the strongest, because they really, a lot of times, have to parent themselves before we figure out that our life is a mess and we need to do something.
Well, there are some unique – oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
There are some unique characteristics of firstborn and only children. I actually did a lot of study at one point on birth order
for
a whole different research I was doing. And there are some aspects that are different from the subsequently born children. And one of them is that they tend to have a lot more expectations of them by adults. They're more likely to be surrounded by adults. Firstborn has a mommy and a daddy, maybe a grandmother, grandfather, aunt, and uncle. There's a very good chance that most of their playmates are adults. And the other thing is that they are expected to perform better, more intelligently, older, because they're the first one. The parents don't know yet that little children don't do those things. And
right.
So they do have a sense of growing up, taking more responsibility, or succeeding. So there are some positives of that. Now, when you overlay on that, if the parent or both parents were somehow traumatized and you add that into the mix, then you could have a very strong, successful person with major problems.
Did she just define me?
What, Annie? Did you have something to say?
I said, did she just define me?
Perhaps, well,
what is happening right now, if we can just simply look at it and have a chuckle, that's part of the healing. That is absolutely part of the healing, is just to see that, oh, my gosh, look what I did. And to be okay with that. I mean, it's, okay, so that's what happens, and what do we want to do now?
Right.
And
hopefully,
go
ahead.
I was going to say, in terms of the cultural trauma, a similar thing can happen if a person is culturally traumatized. In other words, something happened 50, 100, 200, 500 years ago, for that matter.
Right.
But because they are re-exposed over and over to the images, maybe through pictures or drawings, the stories, the songs, telling them what happened. In Scotland, where some of my relatives are from, there was a Battle of Culloden. C-O-L-L-O-D-O-N, I think, is the spelling. And there are undoubtedly still people that resent what happened. It was a horrible massacre. In Native America, there was Wounded Knee and many others. And in Australia, in the outback, there are people that were taken from their family also and tried to be made into something else. And so these intergenerational things that happen when a person comes out of it, when they are perhaps the oldest or the first to recognize what happened, then they do become the leaders. Often they become the leaders of the movement. And so, again, once again, it's kind of like being the oldest kid. You know, you have this great expectation. Well, you noticed it first. You understand it. It happened to you or to someone close to you. Well, what are you going to do about it? And so a person that has not necessarily gone through their own healing has this enormous pressure on them, once again, to perform better, be more adult about it or whatever. And that's a heavy burden for many.
Yeah. And it definitely is hard to be the one who understands how sick the family is when the rest of the family doesn't want to hear it.
Yes.
And instead of them hearing it, they want you to go away, because it's easier to get you to go away than it is to do the work necessary to make the family healthy.
And by the way, that may be a sign that they're experiencing intergenerational trauma. Because, again, when a family member is being traumatized, they want to avoid it. And if I happen to be the one inadvertently re-traumatizing them because I haven't done my healing, they don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
They want me to go away. Or they're going to go away, one or the other.
Well, a lot of these industrial schools, residential schools, all these different places, they really desensitize people to the ability to bond. Now, and then, so if you have a grandparent who really, the ability to love and the bond was literally beat out of them. It takes, I don't know how many generations it takes to begin to undo something that severe.
One.
Because that becomes the root of so many things and addictions
did
and imprisonment.
Did you hear my answer?
No.
One.
What?
It only takes one. But that person has to understand what happened and be willing to do what it takes. One. The other thing about your phrase, and I know that you were speaking metaphorically in some ways, but for a person to have their bonding sense beat out of them, for instance, chances are they didn't have it beat out of them. Chances are it went way undercover.
Right.
Now, whether or not a person ever learned to bond, you know, if they didn't, it's called reactive attachment disorder, that's another matter. And those people are the ones that I'm most concerned about having children, because when a person does not ever form an attachment, a secure attachment to an adult, for whatever reason, and it could be the adult is sitting right there in the house but online 24/7.
Right.
It doesn't matter. Just because we're there does not mean that we're parenting in a way that is healthy for our child. But what I'm saying is that if there's a child that does not have a healthy attachment to an adult and they do develop something called reactive attachment disorder, they have missed a developmental opportunity to learn how to trust and love and will do it differently. Now, it's not to say that they won't do something, because they do end up getting married and having children, but they may not understand empathy. They may have never experienced empathy, and their children may have a very, very difficult time under their care. But in terms of how long does it take to get rid of it? One generation, the very next one. If we become aware enough and we pick it up, we can change it.
But it has to be an aggressive undertaking. It can't be a passive thing. Once you realize that, like I realized within my generation that I didn't want to pass it on, but even having that knowledge base and aggressively pursuing it, it still, I can see pieces of it within my daughter's life and even within my granddaughter's life. Even when I've done everything I can possibly think of, it's still weeding its way through the generations, and I'm trying to you know, meet it at every turn, but it is a very hard thing to get out of once the cycle begins, to grab hold to it and say, you're not getting my child, you're not getting my grandchild. And even when you're aggressively doing it, still, pieces of it still get there and still get them and still affect the quality of their life. And it's heartbreaking to watch it play out.
Could I comment on that?
Yeah.
Because I've kind of been through that. And I'm on the other side now. My kids are grown, and I have grandchildren. They were all in therapy, and they're all in really good relationships. They're happily married. My grandkids are so well-adjusted that it is. I guess what I wanted to put out there is that it's absolutely possible, because I look at my kids, and I'm in awe that they could put all that together after living with me.
Well, you didn't take a passive role in that. I mean, to come from where you came from and to put your children in therapy and all of y'all work on all that is absolutely amazing that you had the mental clarity to understand that's what was needed. Because so
I
many
had a
people,
therapist who showed me the light.
Oh, man. She definitely was good, because.
Well, Annie, you were a lucky one.
She's extremely lucky. Yeah.
You were a lucky one. But it doesn't always have to be. Yeah. It doesn't always have to be a therapist. Thank goodness. Sometimes it can be another family member who sees something happening and does not ignore it, but reaches out to that person. You don't have to be a therapist to reach out from your heart to theirs and just say, hey, I'm here, and mean it.
Yeah. And that definitely is appealing. Go ahead.
I want to give you an example of something that happened today that there was no way of planning it, because I don't brush religion with a broad stroke, and have had some good experiences in my background in that regard, I do attend a church, and I was sitting there this morning, and I love to sing, so I was sitting in the choir loft, and I noticed a man come into the church through the wrong door. He didn't come in with everybody else. He came in late. He kind of walked across the front and sat down. And to me, as a trained professional, I could see some of the signs that this was probably a man who had some mental problems. But there he was in the church, and he wanted to be there. He was looking around. He was standing at times when everybody was sitting and doing things like that. And my greatest concern was that somebody else may get so annoyed with him that they would go and grab his arm and usher him out. That was my greatest concern.
Yeah.
And so what I did instead of just waiting to see what would happen, was when there was a break in the singing, I left the choir loft, took off my choir robe, and walked right across the same way he had and asked him if it was okay if I sat next to him. Now, he looked at me like, oh, gosh, here it comes. She's going to kick me out. I can see it in his face. I mean, you know, this
or
is a man clearly homeless.
Or try to save him or something like that.
Yeah, something. And, you know, he appeared to be a homeless man. He wanted to be there, though. And so I put my hand out gently, and I introduced myself and said, may I sit next to you? And he said yes. And then as the service continued, what I wanted to do was to just let him know that he has somebody on his side, somebody with him.
Yep.
And so when he did these bizarre things, stood up, looked around, whatever, I just sat there, and maybe I'd look around with him, but I joined him in this regard. Not that I had to become bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I did was I said,
very nice.
if you need my help, please let me know. And then I just, you know, paid attention to the sermon and so forth.
Yeah.
I have to say, by the end of the sermon, if this is any example, when the offering plate came around, he reached inside his backpack and he pulled out all the coins he had and he put them in that offering plate. So whereas everybody else was giving maybe 10%, maybe, and that's a huge maybe, he gave 100%. He seemed to be genuinely glad to be there for whatever reason. Now, he may have been delusional. He may have thought he was someplace else. I don't think so. I think he went there on purpose. What I'm saying with this is that we don't even have to know someone. We don't have to like the way they dress. We don't have to have anything in common with them to see their humanity and to reach out and to say, hey, I'm on your side.
Absolutely. And you also put yourself between him and the congregation so that they were safe as well.
What's that?
The buffer. The buffer I think there's an important key there, and I'll be quick because I know you're going to say something. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No,
when I was a young boy, yes, I was young at one time.
you're still young to me, David.
watch it. Okay. There was a young girl that I had as a schoolmate. Nobody talked to her except to insult her, and they picked on her every single day. This girl was traumatized every day. You know, she was not definitely not a homecoming queen. I mean, this is an elementary school, and she was not pretty, let's say mildly. But the boys were really terrible to her. The girls were terrible to her. I felt so bad for her. One day I got really fed up, and as a group of guys were calling her all kinds of names, I stood up and I said, you know what? Leave her alone.
Wow.
And from that time on, the boys left her alone. They didn't bother her because there must have been something on my face that said, you know what? for all the verbal abuse, I'm gonna beat the snot out of you.
Good for you, David.
Nothing is more fantastic than seeing compassion like that. I had a boy in school named Terry, and that poor child, from like fifth grade on, they just demonized him. He wasn't a human being to them, and he would walk down the hall, and I would see people just randomly trying to fight. And this was a nice little kid, just a little redheaded, freckled kid. And so I became his protector at my 100-pound self, and I'd walk down the hall and end up putting myself in between him and the fights to pull him out of it because I knew they wouldn't hit me. And there was one time I came out of the, like, gym, and there literally was, like, six or seven guys standing around him, and he was in the corner. I had to crawl underneath them and get in between just so they would back off and leave him alone. And that's been my greatest lesson in how you can demonize an innocent person.
Yes.
And I've always carried that story of him wherever I go.
Well, Mel, what you're describing and what David just described is that spiritual warrior. You can come up with your own word, but I'm going to call that person
like
spiritual
that
warrior.
A
what
I
each of
it.
You did was reaching beyond all of the societal do's and don'ts.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
listening to your own heart, your own moral compass, if it were, and saying, this is not okay. You know,
right.
I don't have to wait until something horrible happens, a suicide or a killing. I don't have to wait for that. I can intervene. I can do something right now, even if it's nothing more than simply whatever it is, you know. And, by the way, the end of this story is that when the service was over, number one, this man was now speaking to me much more intelligent, or I don't want to say intelligently, but
Coherently,
yes, that's what I'm looking for, than he had at the beginning. He was very agitated at the beginning. And so I think part of him calming down allowed him to be present and to see that, you know, hey, I'm not a foe, I'm a friend. But the other thing that happened is that one at a time, other people from the congregation came up, shook his hand, introduced themselves, and said, I'm glad you're here.
Wow. Because when the invisible become visible, there's nothing to me more powerful than that. When somebody that normally they'd walk past and not even realize that that was a human being, and now all of a sudden he's a real person. And you did that. You made their blinders come off by your showing of compassion. And
but
that's
amazing. It could have been anybody. You know what I mean?
No, I don't know that it could have been anybody because it takes an empathic person to reach out like that. So I don't know that it could have been anyone, but either way.
Well, either that or a foolish person.
Well, you know what? We got to love the foolish people sometimes because they are the ones that change the world. So I'll take it either way, but regardless, I'm so happy that you did that. And it just shows your character, which we already knew, but it definitely shows that your humanity.
Thank you, Mel. I want to connect it back with PTSD in this way.
Okay.
You know, because I told you that I have suffered with PTSD myself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I have had a number of traumas in my lifetime, most of which I won't talk about on the air because there are people that I love involved.
Yes.
But there's one I can talk about on the air, and that was when I worked in a clinic in Northern California, a client whom I did not know was delusional. He was schizophrenic. He came in, armed to the teeth, and shot and killed a number of people. I was the only person that did not get killed who saw him. And what am I saying when I say that here I look in the congregation of a church this morning, I see another person who looks to be delusional, who looks to be mentally ill, probably homeless, maybe desperate, who has a knapsack with him, and I go sit down next to him. Now, one way to look at that is the stupidest thing that I could have done. But I choose
given
not to see
history,
it that way.
Yeah. Given your history, I could see where
given
that could have triggered you completely, and you could have just
absolutely
fled the church.
Yeah.
Wow, that's but even what, that much more amazing that you did it then.
Well, it's because the point I'm making with this is that we can heal.
Yes.
We can heal. And it doesn't have to take a lifetime. It can be, it's just a matter of, you know, somebody reaching out, reaching beyond whatever artificial barriers they believe that surround themselves and just saying, I'm going to do this anyway. I could have sat there and done nothing this morning, and he probably would have been okay. He would have continued to be agitated, and other people would have continued to feel uncomfortable.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I chose, and maybe in part because I went through that.
Maybe so. You knew that the potential existed that could, given the right combination of agitation, could have gone a lot of different ways. So you were doing more than just showing compassion. You were actually, you surveyed the scene and knew that there was a danger that most people didn't comprehend.
Well, 2 weeks ago, in fact, not too many miles away from here in Florida, a man did come in and kill several people in his church. And I have to say, that thought crossed my mind.
Absolutely. You knew exactly what you were doing. And you kept the congregation safe by calming him down and making him human to you. And you
but
human
it wasn't,
to him.
But it wasn't just that. And I think that any time us human beings do anything, it's as they say, it's complicated.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely multi-layered.
Yeah, but
it doesn't
mean that we can't do it anyway. Sure, there was
Absolutely.
A part of me that remembered the clinic. There was a part of me that remembered the shootings. There was another part of me, I think the biggest part of me, that so appreciated this young man. I mean, I so appreciated the fact that he wanted to be in that sanctuary in that moment, and he went in there knowing that people were staring. And I just wanted him to know that he was not alone. Now, Nell, I suspect that there are people like that in your children's lives.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be the parent.
You know, it's funny when you mention that man. There was a homeless man that my daughter saw when she was at the bank, and she went over and asked him if he wanted the rest of her sandwich. And then he ended up taking him some water, and then he talked about Santa Claus. So I bought him some Santa Claus suspenders and sent him down there so that he could have those and stuff. And then she even posted online, she's like, this homeless man that everybody sees every day, take some time and talk to him. He's a good guy. And so it's just those little moments of humanity that let you know that, you know, yeah, they may have come out with some things because of what happened, but they also came out with an understanding of people that's probably far more developed than most.
Go ahead, David.
I'm sorry. When Nell talks about humanity, I think that that is an important aspect of understanding not just PTSD as it affects the immediate victims, but it also, but affecting the children and the grandchildren, is that, you know, the perpetrator of and I'm going to call them crimes, okay?
Yeah.
I think Annie will be in absolute agreement with me. These are crimes that are perpetrated against young boys and young girls that then grow up, and by their perpetrators losing their humanity. Anybody who can perpetrate a crime against a child or an animal, let me go even further, against any part of our natural family. Anybody who can perpetrate these crimes, like corporations and governments and even churches who go against their own tenets, look, they're not human. They've lost their humanity. And what happens in my observation is that if a parent has been traumatized, they lose that part of the humanity, which then further traumatizes their children and children's children. And it's a very complex issue, Nadine, as what I can understand. A mother who is constantly talking of saying negative things about men, for example, if they have daughters of their own, the daughters, by proxy, then start seeing men in the same light as a man who was abused by his mother will probably say all women are bad, and when they get married, they have children, their sons see women in the same light. This is a very dangerous situation when we lose our humanity and we no longer see men as human or see women as human. It perpetuates a very, very inhuman situation. So it's a very complex.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, definitely.
And David, I completely agree with you. I want to go back to one thing that you said. You talked about some of these crimes that happen to young children, and I believe that you're talking about, you know, when the priest molestation or rapes of altar boys or of taking Native children, you know, to these homes where they were brought up, or in Ireland, the laundries and so forth, that those are crimes. I couldn't agree with you more. And you also said not human. They've lost their humanity. And I believe also that that is correct in that these people have done these horrible deeds under the umbrella of institutions and churches, and
exactly.
Absolutely, they are not human. They have lost their humanity when they use cover of an institution to commit horrendous acts against helpless children or anybody, as you said, as you pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
And
but it also
so
doesn't,
how...
So.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Nadine, but it also covers parents. I mean, parents, I mean, Nell and I, we've had Annie on a number of times now on the show. She did a reading where Nell and I were going, my God, as she was reading it, we were there. We saw it, and you know, and parents are not, I mean, they call it the institution of marriage and the institution of the nuclear family. They are no exception to the rule. If parents can do that to their own children, they are not human. And if a husband can abuse his wife and or vice versa, and a wife can abuse her husband, they are not human. They are criminals to do this thing.
And you're right. They
yeah.
are criminals, and at some level. And again, not to belabor the point, but I think that you're really touching on something important.
Yes.
And that is when people lose their humanity or when they give it up or they ignore it is more probably more accurate.
Or didn't develop it to begin with. Yeah.
Yeah. After all, I'm the parent. After all, I'm the priest. After all,
right.
I'm the teacher. After all, I am the government. Whatever it is that we hide behind, yes, we lose our humanity when we do that. Wall Street, yes, we lose our humanity when we hide behind the cover of something that is not human, whether it's marriage or anything else. And I think some of the most horrendous abuses that have been done to children have been done under the cover of, well, I'm the parent, I have a right to discipline my children the way I want to, even if it means forcing them to drink scalding hot liquid.
Right, right.
It is a crime. There's no question it's a crime, but that doesn't mean that that institutions don't commit crimes. What I'm saying is that if we do get in touch with our humanity, somehow, some way, if we can recover that part of our humanity, then mm-hmm. I believe that is how we begin to heal.
Uh-huh.
And that's how we heal others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just jumped on my soapbox. I'll jump back off for a minute.
We love your soapbox. What I want to do before we get more soapbox, because although I love it, is I want to take a quick break, and then we'll come back, and we'll retouch on each one of these and pull any in more. Okay?
Okay.
All right, so we'll be right back.
I've been holding on to a secret, the deep, dark kind that you keep inside. All of my life I've been so mixed up, tried to run but I just can't hide. Every day when I look look in the mirror, I can't believe all the faces I see. I feel stained and I feel dirty, but soap and water never washed me clean. No, this is not my imagination. No, this is not just a very bad dream. What you hear is a true confession of a deep, dark secret that's been haunting me. Sometimes it's too hard to remember. Over memory is killing me. How could someone say they love you and take away the child in me? Every day when I look in the mirror, I can't believe that it's happened to me. I've been hurt and I feel cheated. Finally set me free. No, this is not my imagination. No, this is not just a very bad dream. What you hear is a true confession of a deep, dark secret that's been haunting me. You have is a true confession that the deep dark secret that the deep dark secret set you free, set you free, set you free.
Welcome back to Fire Talk, and for anyone tuning in, I am David Little Eagle. I'm your host with my co-producer, Nell Cole, and we have with us today Dr. Nadine Vaughn Williams, and we have Annie O'Sullivan, author of Can You Hear Me Now? Can You Hear Me Now, Too? We are discussing PTSD, but not just PTSD, but the various levels and the various effects of PTSD, not just for the victims, the immediate victims of crimes committed by parents, by churches, by governments, by corporations, but also what happens to the children and the grandchildren and following generations of the descendants of these precious people. So once again, welcome to the show, and welcome to you, Nadine, and welcome, Annie. Let us pick up from here.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Okay.
What I'd like to do is focus right now on the people listening whose life is kind of in chaos because they have come from such a hard past. And they have their children there who may be struggling with behavior issues or addiction or whatever. And kind of what can we do, what message can we send them to help them get the tools they need to pull themselves out? And I'd like to start actually with Annie and what you saw and what you did to to help pull your children out of that?
Well, excuse me. Well, it didn't happen because I was so smart, I can tell you that.
You're so cute.
Well, you know, I mean, I have to give credit where it's due. I didn't know what I was doing. It never occurred to me that I was causing the harm to my children. And the truth is that I put my kids in therapy. They ended up in therapy before I was in therapy because they started failing at school, and I just didn't know what to do with them. And the school counselor had said, well, you know, maybe some, you know, some counseling will help. So I went through that process. And for me, it was kind of a back door because the kid, my daughter's therapist saw something in me, and she started talking to me. And the rest was history, so to speak. She was a therapist that primarily worked with kids, and that was my first therapist, and as it turned out, that was what I needed. She became a mother figure to me, and I just kind of grew into that. I went to parenting classes, which was huge, because I didn't know about timeout. The concept of putting your child to stand in the corner because they were bad was completely foreign to me. So if they were bad, there was a lot of yelling and screaming because I knew how to do that.
Right.
I wouldn't hit them because I'd been hit. So I think it's a complicated question, and it's probably a complicated answer for a lot of people. It's a matter of trust. Who's going to tell you how to live your life right, and how do you know that what they're saying is true?
Right. And that's a hard road to find sometimes. I see parents struggling with that where they want to get help, but then the system that's in place to give them help is sometimes toxic in its own self or, you know, judgmental. So it's a hard road. Nadine, what do you suggest? Because I definitely want to focus on this for the majority of the show to kind of give some people some framework of what to do to pull their family out of it.
Thanks. Now, Annie, I think that what you did was perfect. We don't always understand or know what's going on with ourselves, especially when we've been through a trauma. And sometimes the only way that we can make it better is when we find out through our children that they need help. I'm being distracted right now. I'm kind of hesitating. I'm at my office and somebody was moving furniture, and I'm going, oh, no, please don't. Okay, now I'm back.
Sometimes our compassion for our children will make us do things that we wouldn't have that same level of compassion for ourselves.
Absolutely. So, and that's why I said, Annie, you did what you did, and it was the perfect thing to do. Now you may do something else, and it would be the perfect thing for you.
Right.
You get my gist?
Oh, yeah,
there is
definitely.
There is no one way that we make that long journey back to health. And it is a healthy place. You know, we become unhealthy when we have these things happen to us, some of us more so than others. And this is one of the things that come up. And by the way, now I want to really appreciate your choice of music today. That one that you just played is just exceptional for this topic.
Well, thank you. And I think Annie originally gave me that for her show. Didn't you, Annie?
That's my favorite song.
Yeah.
I love it. I want to hear it again. Please post it if you would now.
Okay.
But this is the thing that I was thinking about as I was listening to that song. And that is, if we hold ourselves accountable, maybe there's a song here. David.
David, but sing it now.
If we hold ourselves accountable that even though we were victimized,
right,
we are better in spite of it.
Right.
It's not because of it. We are better in spite of it, just like all those people that I mentioned that came through the Holocaust and did amazing things in their lives.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't because of the Holocaust. It was in spite of it. They had to be stronger than ever. And when they got stronger than ever and then they came back into the normal working world, they did tremendous things. So if we hold ourselves accountable, whether we are a victim, whether we are an observer, or whether we are even the perpetrator,
right,
even the inadvertent perpetrator,
mm-hmm,
then and only then will the healing begin. But that's one of the hardest things to do. I mean, how many of us who have suffered,
right,
abuses in the past or traumas in the past have wanted to admit to anything? I've spent a lot of time trying to get things right. I'm not gonna say I did something wrong here, because in fact you didn't about that.
Mm.
But what we do then is what we need to hold ourselves accountable for. You've probably heard this before. I've heard it for many years. As children, we are 100% innocent of what happened to us. As adults, we are 100% responsible for doing what we need to do to make the change that we need. And so earlier
we
were talking
that.
Okay, I will. As children, because probably some people who have not heard it yet. As children, we are 100% innocent of what happened to us. As adults, we are 100% responsible for making the change that we need to live the kind of life we want.
Nadine, I want to thank you for that. Not too long ago, Nell and I had on a stage left and on a Fire Talk show, a wonderful, wonderful lady named Vivian R. Palmer Harvey. And she gave a series descriptions. And now you're I love what you just said, because Vivian covered it in our conversation on the show, and one of the things was, I am right because I'm an adult, or I can do whatever I want essentially because I'm an adult, and you cannot do anything, and you're wrong because you're a child, and this was under the evangelical mindset. She's a missionary kid, and let's call her a survivor warrior of the missionary school system. She was a daughter of a missionary couple, and along with her, there was a lot of physical punishment, physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and
I think I know her.
You do know her. She's on my list. You know her.
She is absolutely fantastic, but it brings you're polite. You know, you're a child. You're to be seen, not heard, and whatever I do to you, you are to be quiet because I'm an adult. I'm right in what I do, and you gotta suck it up and take it in. And frankly, ladies, forgive my French, but that's a crock of shit. You know,
it is a crock of shit.
Yeah.
Yeah,
let me say.
And I'm not even French, and that's a crock of shit.
Yeah.
Well, I do want to make one point here, and I wish I would have understood this when my daughter was young, that the quality of life of my grandchild is a direct result of the quality of life I provide my child. And I had no comprehension of that when she was growing up, but the choices that she made for a husband and all those different things were a direct result of the things that I could have taught her differently. And so in some ways I'm watching my grandchild's life play out, and I'm frustrated that if I would have had the knowledge to guide my child in a different way, then her quality of life would have been different. And so there is some guilt that even though you didn't know and you're just living what you're living, I wish people understood that it should be more of an active, conscious decision of, all right, I'm going to teach my child this so that my grandchild doesn't have to ever experience this. But it's a very aggressive thing. It needs to be a sense of urgency, not a passive like, well, you know, last month we kind of talked about it for a minute and everybody was fine, and that's not going to change the next generation. To change it from severe abuse to a 100% chance of having quality of life is a very aggressive pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
And you have
and
to be diligent.
And the aggression has to be wrapped in love, because if it isn't, then you just substitute one aggressor for another.
No, I didn't mean aggression in that way. I meant aggressive as far as to get healthy, to heal, to put the things in place that you need to unlearn or learn or whatever, so that when that child gets here and the energy she feels from the parent will be healthy energy and not in some process of recovering from something as much as in a good centered place, so that they can concentrate on the child and not their own internal dramas.
What you're saying reminds me of something else that was once told to me and that I absolutely agree with, although it took me back at the time. And this is something for, you know, our listeners to just kind of, you know, hang with me for a minute on this. I want you to imagine, even though you may really, really not want to imagine this, but imagine that you chose your parents.
Okay.
Now, some of you are going to be happy. Oh, sure. Yeah, I imagine I chose my parents. But I want you to imagine that you chose your parents and that you're a person who chose parents that abused you terribly.
For the life lesson.
One might ask, why on earth would I have chosen parents who did those things to me?
I was asked that question this morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually thought about that concept within the reincarnation kind of you choose your next lesson context.
Well, if you can come up with an answer, you don't have to believe in reincarnation to play this little game.
Yeah.
But if you can come up with a really good answer that you can sit with and say, yeah, then the healing has already begun. And I'll give you an example. If I had a parent who shamed me.
Right.
Not that I would ever want any parent to shame anybody, but if I had a parent who shamed me, then I understand better when I see someone who has been shamed.
And if I didn't go through what I went through, then this shows would probably never exist, or my empathy for the children would not be as developed as it is if I didn't go through what I did. So I wouldn't want to unring that bell, but I wouldn't want to ring it again either.
Now, if you take this to a broader level, to a cultural level, which we can, it's a stretch, but it can happen. If these things did not happen to my culture, then what would I be doing? And what can I do because they did? Now, keep in mind that you want this to be thinking in the positive, not in the negative. We all know the negatives. We all know the negatives. But let's say I am of a culture where horrible things happen to me. I'm not Jewish, but let's say I was Jewish. And I'm of a culture where all these, you know, the atrocities committed to me on my family.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do with that reality so that future generations of my family will not continue to be traumatized? Do I want to tell them about it over and over? If I tell them about it, do I want to do it in a way that they have to reimagine the horror? Or do I want to tell them about it, but always make sure that I give them hope? And always make sure that they understand that it's not because people do not have humanity, it's because they have hidden it away, given it away, or sold it.
Yes. That is definitely true.
Yeah.
But there's another aspect to that. You know, what do I tell my children about what happened to their ancestors? I'm a Native man, and I'm friggin' proud of it. But, you know, I've given a number I facilitated a number of classes and presentations regarding the American Holocaust, And the first thing, see, I don't think it's right to point the finger at the descendants of the perpetrators of genocide and of cultural destruction. There, I mean, if you think about it, aren't these victims too? One thing that I would make clear to the students, i.e., is, you know what, this happened a long time ago. It's still happening. We got to be honest about that. But these are people in power doing it. But what did these kids, these high school students, what did these middle school students or these elementary school students have to do with what Columbus did, that jerk? And you know, or what Andrew Jackson did or what George Washington did. What do these kids have to do with that? And there, I've seen other presenters making these kids feel absolutely terrible.
Right.
In my perspective, I say, all right, this is what these historical invaders and viral examples of humanity did to our people. But let me explain something to you, children. I consider you my nephews. I consider you my nieces. I don't care what color you are. And we, you know, if we do not work together, then we're lost. And, you know, I need you guys. I need you to make a difference.
Right.
And these are descendants of the ones that perpetrated horrible crimes against my people. And I'm telling them, we have fed you a line of crap, and we need you young people, to make a difference in the future, and you can. And I think that's what marks the difference between the person who has experienced intergenerational PTSD, who has not found his or her healing yet, and the one that says, you know what, a difference can be made, and has touched on that spiritual, emotional healing.
Yeah. With that
David,
being said, I actually, in my family, am related to Andrew Jackson. And my family talks about it. No. And my family talks about it with pride. And I'm just going like, oh, my God, can we be any more redneck? Oh, my God. No, not Andrew Jackson. But, yeah, they like, act like it's some wonderful thing. And I'm just going like, that's just one more reason why I just can't take it. I just can't take it. So you're talking about full circle here. I'm just messing up Andrew Jackson's line of descendants.
Right. Well, the important thing is, you know, now you're not Andrew Jackson.
No, I am not.
See, that's what for example, we as Native people need to understand, we are a culturally traumatized people. We are even to this very day experiencing genocide, ethnocide, destruction of our cultures and livelihoods. But you know what? The ones we address oftentimes in our programs, our presentations, they are not the ones doing it.
Right.
And
we're powerless.
Okay,
now,
just
David,
like you.
This is my question. David, my question for you.
Yes.
When you teach, and I agree with you, I think that all young people need to understand, particularly young Native Americans, need to understand that the history books are wrong.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
That we did have an American Holocaust and that there are still abuses against Native American people. I absolutely agree, 100% with that. Now what? What do you teach them now so they don't just take it home and say, all is lost and I'm going to kill myself? What do you teach them now so that they can get beyond that and not just stay stuck in it and have their children stuck in it and their children stuck in it? What do you teach them? And that's what I'm getting at, David. It's not that we should in any way ignore what happened or let them off the hook, the people who did that, including the people who keep writing history books that are incorrect.
Absolutely.
Right.
But we have something to do with changing that attitude of being a victim and remaining a victim to becoming a survivor and going beyond.
Right.
Now,
right.
A piece of history you may not know about me is that my father was sent to live with another family for about 15 years because his mother married an Indian man, which is what she always referred to him, an Indian man. And she was literally chased out of her home state by men with guns trying to kill her and take out her children and just make them disappear.
Right.
They didn't want
right.
the children.
Right.
And so I experienced from a very early age what I did not recognize until I became an adult, much later, and what I did not understand was my own father's intergenerational PTSD.
Right.
You know, things happened in his family. He would not talk about it. He would not. And so as a result, I've had to spend an awful lot of time just trying to figure out who my relatives are on that side of, of my family. And
right.
so, but what he did teach me was so incredibly important. And I give him credit for that more than anybody in my life. And that is, he taught me that no matter what happens to you, no matter how horrible it is and how bad it gets, you are not it.
Right.
Right. Right.
You can move beyond it. And that doesn't mean you have to forget it. It doesn't mean you have to forgive even. But you can move beyond it and do more with your life than just sink down into the sorrow and the hopelessness.
And you certainly
and that's
did
my,
that.
And
well,
that's my concern.
Yeah.
Go ahead, David. I'm sorry.
I was just reiterating something you said. It's doing amazing things not because of, but in spite of.
Spite of. Exactly.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Now, when I first went to graduate school many, many, many years ago, I was going to do a dissertation on the effects of rape, what happened after a person was raped, because at the time it was the early 70s. I was on a rape crisis team, and literally every 2 hours, I got beeped because another woman was raped in the county that I lived in. It was just an epidemic. And so when I was going to get my doctorate, I was going to do research on what happens after women are raped. And actually, one of the things that happens after women are raped is a great many of them become stronger than ever, feistier than ever, and they will break your neck if you try
oh,
to do
yeah,
that again.
Absolutely.
And I love it. You know, I love it. But I didn't want to do that research because I didn't want anybody under any circumstances to think there was anything positive about being raped.
Right, right.
But somehow we have to hold both in our hands. We have to hold the reality that something horrible can happen, like the American Holocaust of Native
right.
Americans, and at the same time that we are with possibility. We are with hope. We're pregnant with possibility. We have so much more than what they could ever have taken away that resides inside of us in our DNA.
Right.
Right on.
And that's what we need to put out there. You know, David,
right.
you and I are brother and sister as far as I'm concerned in so many ways. Yeah, I have Scottish ancestors, but that's not who I relate to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I believe that my DNA, the DNA that really matters in my life, and I probably shouldn't say this, no offense to that other side of my family, I love them too.
Love you.
The DNA that I believe has gotten me to the places that I've gotten in my life, which are some of them pretty darned extraordinary, are those that came from my father's lineage.
Right.
Those that came from that struggle, those that came from that trauma and having to overcome that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
The spirit. So that's what I love
so David,
about
David, what do we say?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's what I was just saying is that's what I love about doing these survivor stories. Even though it is very hard, their spirit to come out of pure living hell stronger than
yes.
most people who had a life, a cushioned life, cushy life, is amazing to me. And it does something when you hit as low as a human being can go and then you're pushed even past that, it makes you
mm-hmm.
step into a spiritual realm that most people don't even know exists. And it it does something internally to the mapping of your brain or the chemical workup that rises up your spirit in a more powerful way than most people even can begin to see. So when I see survivors, I look for that spirit and that overcoming, that they astound me every day with their ability and their determination. No matter how many times they get kicked, they just keep coming right back, and I just love that about them.
And if I were one of those young people right now who has, you know, been really fighting to be and to not just fall hopeless, I would love for somebody to come up to me and say, you've got it in you. It's in your DNA to be a warrior. It's in your DNA to be a spiritual warrior. And this is what we're going to do so that this will never happen again.
Exactly. You know, when Nell told me that you, Nadine, were going to be on the show today, I was like, yes. And when she said Annie was going to be on, I said, yes.
You know, I know these women are as strong as you get.
You didn't know I could be so quiet though.
Having met Annie and I know what Nell is talking about, because I've met Annie on this show, and
yes, she is
an incredible inspiration to me.
Yeah.
She's such a beautiful human being. And in spite of everything she's been through, and I met Vivian and I met John Deegan, and I met Sean through Facebook, which, you know, I have mixed feelings about. But I'm meeting all these people. I'm going, hot dang. And, you know, Nell and I were having a conversation, and I write these things. I write a lot and get a lot of comments on them. I can't take the credit when people are liking them and commenting on them and saying, we needed this. It's like you were right there knowing how I feel, and I can't take the credit. You guys, you, Nell, you, Annie, and my awesome sister Nadine, I mean, you guys are inspiration to me.
And you, David. You're being a little too modest. You are
David,
you
wow.
are my favorite warrior right now besides my son.
Oh, no.
I can't say you're my favorite because I do have a son who's a warrior. He is a warrior. But boy, you're right up there.
Yeah, and definitely because I am extremely particular about who gets close to survivors, especially in when it's an intimate setting, and usually male energy is something that I would be very cautious of, but David is one of the most compassionate human beings I've ever met, and I'm just so excited to have him with me.
Because of what you've been through, David.
Yes, exactly.
Because of what you've been through, you had to grow, you had to move beyond that, or you wouldn't have stayed on the planet.
That's right.
You know, I know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah, don't argue with Nadine, David.
You can argue. You can argue. Actually, the reality is I used to say, you know, you can argue, but it's not going to do you any good. Now I say I'll listen.
You're not going to win, but go ahead.
I will listen.
All right, well, we are starting to run more, about 20 minutes left. So I wanted to start wrapping up. And Annie, I'd like to start with you. And is there anything within the show that we've talked about that you would like to add to, or anything within your story?
Well, actually, this has just been really educational for me. You know, I know that you know now because we've talked so much that my website and my Facebook page have been wildly successful, and I hear from people who have read my book, and the response has just been remarkable to me, and I think I got a little insight today that I am on the right track, that I am doing
the
right thing, because they contact me, and what I'm giving them is they know I've really been there, and they know I get it. And when I say, come on, you can get through this, you can do it, they believe me. They believe me because I've been there. And I don't think I really got that until today. And so thank you for that. It's
thank
nice
you.
To know, you know, you're in the right direction.
You
and,
definitely are.
The other thing I would like to say is I've posted this on my page often, and since there was so much conversation about being defined by your experiences, and that can be a really bad thing. I would just like to say I post this all the time. If you were in a car accident, you wouldn't let them call you car wreck. Don't let your experiences define who you are. He's breaking up so bad. What's he saying?
Can you give your webpage and all before we transition to Nadine?
Sure. It's www.writersportal.org/ Can You Hear Me Now? And I'm on Facebook at Annie O'Sullivan 2009@yahoo.com.
And definitely add her. She has a lot of great information. And read her books because you will really enjoy them. And we're looking forward to the one coming soon, I hope.
Oh, yes.
And Nadine, what would you want to add to everything that we've been saying?
I think that we have had a wonderful conversation.
Me too.
And I totally appreciate and agree. I mean, I don't always agree with what everybody says in places in my life, but I do so much with each of you, and I respect you tremendously for what you're doing. Annie, I hope that we become friends. Because you are definitely a person that I spark to and would love to be a friend with. Okay, all right, I'm not hard to find. Although I have been offline for a few days, I have to say I've been desperately trying to finish up two writing projects that I get online like so many people, and it's just, as I said to Nell, it's a seductive mistress, you know.
Because Annie's trying to write, too, right now, and finish her third book.
You have to shut it off.
I have to tell you, Nadine, you have caused me separation anxiety. Okay, so.
Well, I'm definitely still there. It's just that I've been working on the turning my book into a movie, and I will say the name. It's Native Land, Lost in the Mystery of Time. So we're working on, you know, contracts and stuff like that with marketing and all that. But then in the middle of that, my wonderful husband, who is my 100% partner in life and in work, made contact with Match.com on another book that I'm writing called 10 Days to Love, and it talks about how he and I actually met online. 10 years ago.
Do you know, I met my husband online, too.
Did you really?
I did. It's been about 14 years. So that was way back at the beginning, I think. Like,
yes, it is.
Like, we cranked the computer up.
But
I met him online.
So as a result, you know, he made this contact, this wonderful contact, and so all of a sudden, you know, I had two things staring me in the face. So basically I said, no more internet until I get some things off my desk, except today.
And can you give your web page as well?
Sure. My online website, well, you can either find me at all one word, NadineVaughn.com, or NativeLandProductions.com, and that one you'll see more about our projects and my husband and I. NadineVaughn.com is just about what I do. And of course, I have a Facebook presence with both of those as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
David, is there anything that you wanted to say before we wrap up?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was going to share a song with my own closing comments.
Fantastic.
To all our listeners, and again to Annie, and to you, Nadine, and to you, Nell, and to all the people out there who have experienced traumas in your life. But not just to you, my friends, but I'm going to send out a word to anybody who even thinks of perpetrating any crimes against a child, against any animal, against any man, any woman, or even against our very Mother Earth herself and Father Sky. To those who are warrior survivors, you are warriors, and you are not alone. That's what these shows are about. You are not alone. And to the perpetrators of these crimes, I'm a musician, but I am also the chief of a warrior society, and I am surrounded by many warriors that are not only reaching out to those who have been hurt, we're keeping an eye on you. We're watching you. We will watch over our children, and we will watch over our women. We will watch over our brothers, and we will watch over Mother Earth and Father Sky and all our relations in between. That's what we're here for. We're watching, and we're not going to let this happen for long. And with that, I am going to play this song, and I want to send this song out to all our listeners, and this comes from my heart to you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.